Welcome to the Voice of Florida Architecture. I'm your host, Rhonda Hammond, and we're back today with our next installment of Architecture in You, the collaboration between AIA Florida and the Florida Foundation for Architecture. My co-host today is Stephen Ruby, who is chair. Stephen, why don't you tell our viewers or listeners a little bit about the collaboration and then introduce our award-winning guest for today.
Well, good morning, Rhonda. It's always a pleasure to share the screen with you. We at Florida Foundation for Architecture are so pleased to be joining you in your mission to promote our profession through these video podcasts. Our vision for this series, this particular series, is to explore with our viewers the spaces we live in, work in, and play in, and maybe even dream about. We'll be diving into a topic that affects all of us in so many ways, even if we don't really always understand that. And that is the value of architects and architecture in our everyday lives. When we think of architecture, we might picture a famous building or an eye-catching design, but architecture is so much more than that. It shapes our communities, influences how we feel in spaces we move through, and helps us solve real-world everyday problems, whether they be housing, climate change, safety, or public health. Architects do not just design buildings. They imagine better ways for us to live together. In this series, we'll be exploring examples of why architecture matters, what architects really do, and how good design can improve our lives in ways we might not be expecting. Today, we have the pleasure of having a conversation with David Corbin, AIA. David is a principal of David Corbin Architects, Naples, Florida-based architectural firm. The firm's work is marked by thoughtful detailing and careful response to Florida environment with a 21st century take on Florida architecture. David provides clients with an architecture unique to its environment. He has been at the forefront of design community in Florida, winning more than 30 awards from the American Institute of Architects at the national, state, and local levels. Because of his firm's dedication to the missions of nonprofit clients, David was recently named Citizen Architect by the Florida Association of American Institute of Architects. David is a graduate of the School of Architecture at Mississippi State University, where he studied under Samuel Mockbee, a founder of the Rural Studio and recipient of the AIA Gold Medal. He is a member of American Institute of Architects and is licensed in the state of Florida. He's also a LEED certified accredited professional. And good morning, David. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Good morning, Stephen.
This morning, we want to have a conversation about your work. It's very impactful. It's very unusual for in its clientele and the way you approach design and environment. Your firm is probably the most prolific sustainable architectural firm in Southwest Florida. Sustainability is a term that has so many meanings, and I don't think most people understand what it is and why it's important. How does a sustainable building differ from just the average building that you see on the street?
Well, I think the main thing that differentiates, well, first of all, thank you for having us, having me on here. It's I'm very honored to be asked to participate in this program. I think it's great that the foundation is looking to kind of get the words of architects out to the public, but and to help to understand some of these things we deal with every day, and just kind of assume everybody understands it. Sustainability to me is, and I guess I'll go back to my college days in the late 80s. I don't think they were really talking about sustainability, but what we were learning about was making buildings that reacted in a positive way to their environment and their surroundings. And that's what we were taught to do. And I always remembered that and thought that was something very important to do. And now that has, I think, global implications, not just, you know, doing something that works well for your site, but if you do something sustainably, it is impactful for, I think, the entire world. Sustainability to me means a building that responds to its environment. It's designed and constructed to be on that particular place. You know, a building in Florida shouldn't look like a building in Minnesota. It's responding to different things. And I think a very important part of sustainability is doing something that has a light footprint, something that helps us to reduce our carbon footprint and our impact as humans on our environment. So those are the things that are important to me with sustainable architecture.
When it comes to architecture, why is it important to consider these things?
I think it's, and so I guess I'm one of those that I do believe that, you know, humans are having a, you know, negative impact on our climate, and that the earth is warming. And I think that, and we as architects, I guess, have a sort of outsized position in that, because the built environment, you know, is one of the largest producers of carbon, of all, you know, more than manufacturing, more than transportation. So the built environment is a big part of, you know, what puts, you know, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And so I think as architects, and I think the AIA is doing a very good job of making people aware that this is the case. And so I think we we're in a unique position to be able to design buildings that have a lighter impact and can start to, you know, use less energy, you know, be more mindful of how to build in urban environments than just about any other profession there is, you know. And so we can, I think, you know, I think except for politicians who make laws that can help control these things, I think as architects, we're probably next in line as being able to have the most impact on our environment of really anybody in the world. So I think it's important. I wish I weren't that unusual. I wish this were, you know, every architect in the AIA were kind of practicing this way. You know, we're happy to kind of take the mantle and help push it forward.
You say the built environment is one of the largest producers of carbon and greenhouse gas. And I think most people think, well, it's the automobile. It's burning and generating electricity. We know that it is cradle to grave. And I don't think many people explain why the built environment has such a huge impact, has a huge footprint on our environment.
Yeah, I think you're right, Stephen. I think most people think of buildings kind of in their finished state, you know, which, you know, the building's sitting there, but of course, you know, running air conditioner, you know, burning different fuels to make, whether it be electricity or propane, you know, to heat it. That's obviously a big part of it, but also constructing buildings, you know, has a massive impact. You know, if you're pulling rock out of the ground, you're using a lot of water, you're using forest products, you know, to whether it be for, you know, making plywood or you know, lumber for walls and floors and that sort of thing. There's materials that get shipped from China and Europe and things like that. So you have all the sort of carbon and the fuels to kind of move things around the world to come and be part of your building right there. And so, yeah, I think that, and I think that's called, I think it's called what, the embedded carbon of the building. It's that process, which is in the whole lifespan of a building is a huge part of it. And so if you can not only reduce the energy that the building uses after it's constructed, but also kind of reduce the materials and the, you know, the items that are kind of pulled from the earth to build that building, the more sustainable it is. And if you can reuse, you know, if you're using recycled products such as steel, or if you're rehabbing a building instead of building a new one, you know, that's much more sustainable. So that's some of the things that we look to do whenever we can.
And that's interesting that you say reusing and repurposing a building. We in South Florida, so often you see a house that's 20 years old demoed to build a bigger house. Where does all that material go? It is, you know, it's embedded carbon, but it gets put into a landfill or incinerated. So I think you're right. I mean, but why don't we see more repurposing and reusing in South Florida?
One thing about South Florida, and this is, you know, this is a challenge all the time, is that in Naples, where you and I practice, a whole lot of the county is below floodplain, and you can be working on a building that's only, you know, 10 years old that was built to FEMA codes from just 10 years ago, and now it doesn't meet the code. So you either have to tear it down or have to do all these gymnastics to make it work within the current rules. And of course, those rules of flooding are very important also. That has to do with, you know, another term that we use a lot as architects is resiliency, but it does impact our ability to reuse existing buildings. For instance, one of our most recent projects was the Naples Players Theater, which was a big renovation in addition to an existing building that's over 30 years old. But, you know, we kept the existing building and did a lot of adds and additions to it. But, you know, we kept hundreds of tons of materials from going into the landfill by saving that. And that, you know, we got recognized for that. So so that's an important one. And I guess if I could share my screen, I can show you like maybe a couple of examples of what I've been talking about.
Yeah, I'd like to know what design principles and techniques you used to solve some of these problems.
Right. Well, this building here that I'm showing in particular is one that's it's very unusual, but it does show some of the ideas that I'm talking about. And this is a project out in the Fakahatchee Strand State Preserve. And this is just a simple pavilion and a bridge leading to it. The Fakahatchee is the largest and most remote state park in Florida. Really, the only way to kind of get deep into it is by, you know, putting on hip waders and getting out into the swamp. And our clients wanted to provide a better way to do that. So when we were asked to take on this project, these ideas that we're talking about, I think, were very understandable for this site, you know, because it is such a pristine site. But in this case, we wanted it to not only be a sustainable building once it's completed, but we also felt it very important that the ways that it's constructed be very sustainable and have a very light footprint. So, you know, we didn't want to have these, you know, massive pile driving rigs, you know, drive out into this pristine environment and drill piling. So we used a system of helical piles and pilings that could be driven by these small track, you know, basically a bobcat, you know, that can go out and they can lay down some mats for them. And then once they're done, they pull out and the grasses pop back up. So this is one that, based on wanting to have a very light footprint for very specific reasons, you know, we were able to convince our client that. And this is also one that, as I mentioned, during construction, that embodied carbon is you have issues if you're bringing, you know, materials in from all over the world. Well, this is made almost 100% by things that are manufactured right here in Florida. Using steel is always a good thing down here because most steel that's made in the United States is about 100% recycled. You know, so this building is made, or the main construction material is steel and concrete. Obviously, the concrete is manufactured, you know, within a 50-mile radius, so you're not traveling a long way for that. We use some cypress wood on the building, which is sustainably farmed in Louisiana, which is close by. And as you can see from the solar panel, this building is off-grid. What little need there is for electricity out here is handled by solar power. So this thing, you know, literally has no footprint. There's nothing. It's not taking anything from the environment. And so that's, you know, I think this is a kind of an exceptional idea of what we're talking about. But then it also serves that purpose of making the public aware of this, you know, pristine environment we have in Florida. It gets people out into the wilderness on the wilderness's terms. You know, you're not going out in a swamp buggy or something like that. You're just walking out into the environment, and you get to stand at the edge of it without having a whole lot of impact on it. And this is one that I put these pictures in here. We're kind of thinking back to, you know, sustainability, especially in Florida, goes back to the, you know, the Miccosukee and the Lusas, and then after them, the, you know, the Florida Crackers, who built with what they had available. You know, they didn't have air conditioning, so there's certain things that we've been doing in the South for hundreds, if not thousands of years to build sustainably and make a building comfortable without using a lot of, you know, a lot of fuel. So this is kind of a modern interpretation of that type of building.
Beautiful project. Beautiful. There's a lot of the design principles that are you've expressed. What else have you done other than it's maybe more in an urban context, or maybe something that isn't out in the wilderness? That
of course, that's kind of an interesting one.
A few things here in Naples that stand out in my mind.
This building here, which is just down the street from my office, this is the Lutzer Professional Center. This is right on US 41. It's probably a mile from the beach. And this is a longtime client who wanted to do a speculative office building. The Luckerts are a longtime Naples family, a third generation developer. They're responsible for most of the kind of high-rise buildings along the beach in Naples. They wanted to build a speculative office building, and they came to us. We had the idea of doing a LEED certified building, and the way we couched it with them is that it's a Class A building, and a lot of the things that it not only has to do with sustainability when you do a LEED certified building, but it also has to do with indoor air quality, you know, doing things that improve comfort, that improve, you know, natural daylighting. So it's just a very holistic way of certifying buildings. And we showed them, you know, instances where developers of similar buildings in large cities have found that doing LEED certified buildings allows them to actually charge more for rent. You know, it makes it a more desirable place to be. And so they bought into it with us and allowed us to do this building, which turned out to be a, you know, LEED gold certified building. And, you know, we're very proud of it. It's a very prominent building in Naples. It's VentureX, which is kind of a group work franchise that was founded in Naples. They take the entire third floor. And then actually our clients moved their offices from a place where they'd been for 30 years into the second floor. So I think they all became believers. So this building, kind of one of the things that we wanted to achieve here is design a building with kind of as few materials as possible. That was kind of an internal goal. It was really wasn't something our client was necessarily interested in. But it's a term that they use in the USGBC books, and they call it delamination. But it's instead of, Stephen, as you know, when you do like a luxury home down in Naples, the wall section might have more than a dozen different materials in it, you know. And these are all things, you know, if it gets flooded or if there's any kind of water damage, there's just a lot of things to go wrong, to get moldy and things like that. So we really wanted to reduce this building down to, you know, basically steel and concrete. I mean, steel, concrete, and glass. And that's, for the most part, what we're able to do. So, and again, it goes back to one of those sustainable ideas, is that use fewer materials. And there's fewer things to extract from nature to make the building work. And so that was kind of one of our guiding principles up here. And plus, I've always wanted to do an all concrete building. And this was our first success in that. I'll just kind of talk about some of the sustainable principles. This is the site plan, and you can kind of see that the building, the second and third floor, kind of overhang the parking, which does a few things. But the one thing is, if you hear stories about how cities like Chicago and Toronto and New York get so hot in the summertime, and where the surrounding areas aren't necessarily so hot, that has to do with what's called heat island effect, where all the paved areas get really hot and just drive the overall temperature up. And so one of the ways to do that is to take areas of parking and cover it up with buildings, so you're actually parking in the shade. And so we've done that to a large extent here. And then yet you also solve that by, you know, doing a lot of landscaping. You know, we were able to, by, you know, locating the building over the top of parking. You can also see here that we've got a lot of glass, but we've also designed these custom fabricated shade elements that keep the sun off the windows, while at the same time allowing just direct floor to ceiling windows basically on all sides of the building. So one important thing down in South Florida is keeping the sun off of the walls does a huge amount to keep the building cooler inside. And you can also see from this plan here, this section, how we've staggered the floor so that the sun coming from the south, each floor is protected by the floor above from direct sunlight coming in. So that's something that was very important to us here. And then at this lower section, you can kind of see how we're overhanging large amounts of the building over the parking in a lot of the areas. That's been successful. Plus, it makes for the most popular places to park. Another aspect of this building is the fact that it's in an area where it's not a flood zone. It's at about elevation 15 here, which you and I know that's very high for Naples. But we also, even in areas where you're above FEMA, you can still have localized flooding. So we, even though the overall building is built up high, we actually raised the ground floor up 18 inches. So any kind of localized flooding doesn't get inside the building. We do know that the CEO of the company lost power and his home got flooded. So he wound up sleeping in his office for a few days because we also put showers downstairs for people who ride bicycles to the office. So this building kind of does a lot of things that are important to us as far as sustainability. You can see in the elevator lobby here, we've used bamboo, which is a rapidly renewable material. It's something that grows from seed to being ready to be harvested within just a couple of years. And so then it can be farmed again. So it's basically like a crop, you know, that can be, it's a material that's very easily reused and has a light footprint. So this is one that kind of, I think, speaks to a lot of our ideas of sustainability.
Given all these things, what would you recommend to our listeners? What could they do to make their environment more sustainable without, going through major construction and hiring one of us to figure it out for them? What just are some simple principles that they could follow?
I think another thing that I really haven't mentioned, which is very important, especially in Florida, well, I think in most places in the country now, is water, is conserving water. And that's a pretty easy thing to do. That's very low-hanging fruit. My wife has a cistern at our house where she waters all of our plants from that. Things like low-flow toilets and shower heads, taking short showers and things like that, I think can reduce the amount of water that you have to use by a bunch. And also using landscaping that is native to Florida that doesn't require a whole lot of watering once it gets established. So I think that's an easy thing to do. I mean, almost everybody's using LED lights. If you do have to replace, like if you want to go put in new windows because of hurricane protection, you can put in insulated and low E windows, which basically with our new technology with glass is like today's modern windows are just about as energy efficient as a 4-inch insulated stud wall, you know, so it's, you can do things like that without really starting from scratch. Also, if you replace your roof, you know, do like a light colored standing seam roof or a white roof. It used to be very popular down there and still is in a lot of instances for people to do these concrete tile roofs. And those are basically act as a heat sink where it holds heat against the roof of your house, even at nighttime. It sits there and absorbs all the heat during the day. And then that heat gets dissipated into your home at nighttime, you know. So if you do something like a standing seam roof, it basically that heat is reflected back out very quickly and doesn't come into your home. Yeah, so those are some things that you can do that are pretty easy.
Yeah, those are easy. And those are a lot of them are just our everyday operations. And also when we upgrade our house and when we do things, we replace a roof, keep these things in mind. I want to move on to a different topic here. Many of your clients are nonprofit and philanthropic organizations. Why have these organizations become an important part of your portfolio?
Well, I think it's one of those things that it's just for the most part, serendipity. And it's just basically of interesting things coming together. You know, when I hung up my shingle to start my own office was in 2009, just right in the middle of the downturn, when it was probably the worst time in the last couple of generations to start an architecture firm. And one of my early clients that I met actually through a local leadership program was a Methodist minister who was operating a kind of a small community center out of what used to be a Methodist church in Golden Gate City. And kind of this, it was, you know, this right here, Golden Gate City during the downturn had gone from a predominantly white working class neighborhood to a almost entirely working poor migrant community that's with basically no tax base, very little, you know, income for these families. And so her congregation disappeared, you know, and, but she didn't want to abandon her community or the church. And so she basically turned it into a community center. And when we started working for her, actually on a pro bono basis, I wasn't making any money doing anything else. So, you know, so I was able to kind of take on a job. And so one of my first projects out of the gate when I started my office was what came to be known as Grace Place for children and families in Golden Gate City, which, as you know, is one of the densest neighborhoods in Florida. It's one of the poorest communities, one of the poorest zip codes in the state. She saw a need and wanted to make a difference. And this is a project that went from first renovating that existing church to doing five more phases over a period of 8 years. And the impact that this organization has had on this community is just staggering. I mean, the numbers, they're the largest distributor of Harry Chapin Food Bank food in Southwest Florida. They give away over 250 tons of food a year, which is unfortunate, but it's, you know, it's what they do, and they do it out of a building that we designed, you know, so that makes us very proud. We got a lot of recognition for this over the years. We were able to take clients and tour this. Obviously, nonprofits would come see this and love it and want for us to do a similar thing for them. So it just continues to be a fountainhead of this type of work for us. And I guess the thing that I tell clients is that I think what's traditionally happened with nonprofit clients is that somebody on the board has got so-and-so was my architect on my house. You know, you should hire him to do it, you know, and he'll do it for free or do it for a reduced cost. And my thing is like, look, if it's worth doing well, it's worth paying for. And we don't do it as a sideline. It's, you know, we put our best interest in this because we believe that the people who occupy and use these buildings are just as deserving of good architecture as those people in Port Royal and on Fifth Avenue, you know. And I think that resonates with a lot of people. You know, you can go onto the Grace Place website and see all the numbers that of just the tens of thousands of people who have run through here. Their high school program, where they mentor and work with over 100 kids a year, have 100% graduation and acceptance to college rate. I mean, it's just unbelievable what they're able to do here. But the other thing too is we convinced them or told them that what you're doing is community sustainability. You should think about doing a building that's environmentally sustainable. And so this is a LEED certified campus, and every building is LEED Gold certified. Yeah, I mean, it's we couldn't be more proud of it. My favorite part of going on their website is seeing the impact, and kind of selfishly as an architect, it's just amazing to kind of see every single photograph has your buildings as the background, you know. So it's just moving to look at this, and it's just, I'm just very happy to be able to have the opportunity for our firm to be kind of pointed in this direction. And we're obviously very fortunate to have a great team of professionals, of architects that help us get there. So I think Grace Place is kind of our firm in a nutshell, I think.
Do you have to do a hard sell for the LEED certifications, or is that just part? I know it's part of your culture from me getting to know you and seeing you through the awards that your firm has won throughout the years, but is that become like your basic service, or do you have to do a hard sell to each client? I love the way you just said that you told them you're sustaining the community and let's do the building that way too. So how does that work?
I have to admit for Grace Place that we paid for it out of our pocket as far as like the administrative portion of it. What I tell people is basically all our clients are getting LEED buildings, whether they get certified or not. But as you guys know, that to do LEED certification, the time to do it is cost tens of thousands of dollars. And, you know, luckily, you know, John Gernis, who's principal at the office and was project architect on this, basically took it on his shoulders and did it. And any consultant that we had to have, we paid for out of our pocket because we felt it very important to have that on this project. Now, since then, you know, we've been more successful of getting clients to pay for it. You know, the Naples Players Theater paid for it, and obviously the Lutgerts did too. But whether it's paid for or not, we're building and designing buildings under the same guidelines that we do LEED certified buildings. You know, at least 50% of our buildings would be able to be LEED certified anyway. I don't know if you guys have heard of the Living Building Challenge, but there's only about, I don't know, less than 25 of them in the world. But these are buildings with absolutely no carbon footprint at all. They don't take any energy. They don't leave any waste. They don't take any water. Stephen, I know you're probably familiar with the Corkscrew Sanctuary here as an Audubon property, which is the largest old growth swamp in, I think, in the world, if not in the United States. And right now they have a visitor center. We're doing a big addition of laboratories, dormitories, offices, and then outdoor classrooms. And we've been talking to them about this, and they're interested in doing it. We're not to the finish line by any means, but the main thing they have here that makes it possible is what they call a living machine, which handles all of the human waste on site without, you know, kind of, and it actually uses it to kind of grow plants and that sort of thing. And it was designed to be able to handle the addition we're doing. So this is a building that we're, you know, very excited for. It's going through site planning right now.
It's very interesting that it because there are very few of those buildings around the world. You know, it's very difficult to be able to make that those buildings self-sustaining, as you say. What are the challenges when you're working with a nonprofit or a philanthropic? I know you're very excited about it and you're passionate about it. So I think that those you see the opportunities of helping the community and being impactful. But I know that as you go through that process, there's frustrating issues and challenges that trip you up. You mentioned in the first project you just talked about that the state of Florida was one of your biggest nemesis in making that project real. Talk to us about some of the things that, you know, maybe if your clients and the public could make it easier for to do this.
Well, I think probably the biggest thing is there's always limited budgets. You know, you almost never get a great budget for a project. And so you have to be very careful on with how the money is used. But I think a lot of our projects for commercial clients have larger budgets. And I think you definitely have to have a client who's interested, who I think is kind of like-minded, and also their kind of board of directors feels that it's important to kind of try to do better with buildings serving the, you know, more vulnerable populations. Sometimes even the people who kind of run these organizations aren't necessarily interested in that. So being able to find clients who kind of think that way about the people they serve, I think is also very important. Otherwise, you know, I find, you know, nonprofits clients to be very professional, kind of easy to work with. They usually admit that, you know, they know very little about the building process and they kind of feel like you're doing a great job. You know, they'll kind of stay out of your way. We've found that we have a lot of design freedom and a way to sort of think progressively about architecture with our nonprofit clients, you know, even more so than a lot of our commercial or hospitality type clients.
This is a question I ask everybody I interview. I want to know what project in your career you're the most proud of and has been the most impactful to your client and your community.
Well, I think, you know, obviously I've sort of told you about one of them, which is Grace Place. But I think the one that I've kind of got on the screen right now, the Shelley Stayer Shelter, is another one that has just as much of an impact and it's had a, you know, big impact for us also. This is out in Immokalee, which, you know, it's kind of poor as Golden Gate City is. You know, Immokalee is even more distressed because it's a kind of a farming community. It's the population goes up and down when the crews of migrant workers come into town, and they are almost always living in substandard housing. Very few people have cars. Most people are walking and riding bikes, and there's very little English spoken. A very good friend of mine is the CEO of the Naples Women's Shelter, who has a shelter in Naples, but what would happen in Immokalee, which is about a 40-mile drive from Naples, the people who would have domestic violence issues, they would bring them to the shelter in Naples, but they wouldn't stay as long as they need to because they wanted to get back home. And so they needed to have an outpost in Immokalee. And plus, Florida has one of the largest occurrences of human trafficking in the country. A place like Immokalee has, you know, a big part of it in the state. And so they wanted to have a human trafficking, a shelter for human trafficking victims. And from what we could find, we couldn't find another purpose-built new shelter for victims of human trafficking in the country. And so we feel like we're the first ones here. And, you know, this is, we think, can be a model for similar projects or for similar things, you know, elsewhere in the country. I think we were very fortunate to be recognized for that from AIA National, because we won a Justice Facilities Award for that project this past July, so or June, I guess it was. Again, the numbers, I don't have them offhand, but just the number of like counseling hours and the hundreds of families who have come through this facility to stay and to heal and to kind of get themselves back into society has, again, just been staggering. The number of human trafficking victims that have come through here and successfully gotten themselves back into their former lives, I think is that's something that's extremely rewarding. Again, we like to think that our designing our idea to make this a structure that feels more inviting, that doesn't feel institutional, helps with the healing. A big part of the healing is being able to feel comfortable, be able to feel secure, and be able to feel like you have your own place. And you know, we try to make all those things happen in this project. And from our discussions with our clients, you know, it's been very successful in doing that. So yeah, I think this is one that we're extremely proud of, that, you know, we've gotten some recognition for, and you know, think it serves its purpose.
Your work, your portfolio of work, and while you talk about it, is a perfect example of what we at the foundation are talking about, that architects just don't do buildings. It isn't just about the materials and the roof and keeping the water out. It's about solving problems, real world problems, people's problems, and thinking about how they feel in that space, how they use that space. I don't think the average person understands, you know, they think an architect just, you know, makes the four walls and the roof and makes it look pretty. But, you know, I think you're a perfect example of how you delve into the essential problems, the existential problems of a client, and the architecture flows out of that. It evolves out of the problem, out of the solution to the problem, and out of your passion and sensitivity for the people you work for. So,
well, thanks. That means a lot. And I think you put it very well.
Do you have anything else to add to our little discussion here?
Again, I feel very fortunate to have the team that I have, that is, you know, is a huge part of this. You know, we've got, we're a small firm, but we do have, you know, four licensed architects and AIA members. And I think that's important that we are, you know, all are kind of thinking the same way about the projects that we're working on. So, you know, I definitely wouldn't be able to do it by myself. And I just feel fortunate that we're able to do projects that get us excited and that we think do have an impact on our community and are able to make a living at it. So I think that's very rewarding, and I'm glad I'm able to practice that way.
Well, architecture is a team sport.
Well, thank you, David, for joining us and being a part of this important conversation, and most especially for sharing your work that demonstrates how thoughtful design and good stewardship can be both inspirational and purposeful for generations, just like your Human Trafficking Healing Center you just shared with us.
Well, thanks, Rhonda. Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm happy you guys wanted to include me on this. It's exciting.
Thank you, David. We appreciate it.
And Stephen, thank you for your efforts bringing this series to fruition and serving as co-chair.
Always enjoy working with you, Rhonda.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Architecture in You. Stay tuned for future episodes as Stephen and I explore examples of why architecture matters, what architects really do, and how good design can improve our lives in ways we might not expect. This is Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your host of The Voice of Florida Architecture, a podcast of AIA Florida.